Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy. Good koutou. Morning, Dave. The June's clinical snippets. I'm really looking forward to learning again from you. Do you want to introduce yourself to the hundreds and thousands of people that listen to the podcast?
Morena tato, Dave Mapleston, General Practitioner and Advisor for Health and Disability Commissioner. And this is just a whip around a few bits and pieces I've come across in my reading that might be helpful on a practical basis with patient management, and also my interest in helping avoid errors and minimise patient complaints.
So let's launch into it, Dave.
So the first one, just a recent BPAC bulletin that came out that looked at a 2023 British Journal of General Practice article on appropriate withdrawal of SSRIs. Yeah. That's SSRIs, I do get a significant number of complaints about, usually around either withdrawal or patients that have perceived they've developed serotonin syndrome because of co-prescribing of, say, tramadol or codeine with an SSRI. And we talked about serotonin syndrome on a previous episode, but I'm concentrating on the withdrawal in this one. So the paper gave quite a lot of good practical advice, but basically suggesting a proportionate dose taper that should be used where the dose is produced by a proportion of the previous dose, e.g. 50% of the previous dose, but depending on certain factors such as the symptoms, whether the available formulations allow the preferred reduction dose, but also advising that as you get to lower doses, an even smaller proportionate reduction might be necessary. So the dose tapering should occur slowly over months to years, depending on individual circumstances. And obviously higher doses of SSRIs or longer durations of SSRIs with shorter half-lives may be associated with more severe withdrawal symptoms and may require tapering at a slower rate. So a bit of individualizing is necessary. They recommend monitoring patients with symptoms of withdrawal and to differentiate between withdrawal and relapse of depressive symptoms. So symptoms of withdrawal that might be suspicious include irritability, and again, could be difficult to distinguish between withdrawal and relapse, but irritability, sleep disturbance, hallucination, suicidal ideation, dizziness, headaches, and sweating, which are reported by more than half of patients when discontinuing SSRIs.
But turmeric solves all of those problems, Dave. Did you not know?
Well, that wasn't in the how to cope with the withdrawal. I'll add in turmeric, but reinforce the use of coping strategies such as exercise, mindfulness-based techniques, sleep hygiene, and just be prepared to slow the taper if withdrawal symptoms occur, despite the turmeric. So the withdrawal symptoms are more likely to begin within days of discontinuation or reduction, whereas the relapse symptoms typically occur weeks to months after cessation or into the cessation period. And probably quite importantly, just to discuss the possibility of withdrawal symptoms, including the importance of following the tapering protocol to minimize any symptoms. So that's a lot around the whole informed consent, etc. issue, warning particularly that patients shouldn't abruptly stop taking the SSRI. So MedSafe have developed a handout, which is available here. Well, I've got a link to the handout. Quite a handy one to give to the patient that basically covers the withdrawal side of things and importance of following the regime. And there's an excellent or brief summary on relevant information about switching or discontinuing antidepressants in New Zealand formulary that I've got a link to as well. And I think one of the handicaps we have here, because this is a British article and they have lots of liquid preparations of SSRIs, whereas we don't.
Yeah.
So I've included a link to a really good guide on what medications can be crushed or dissolved. And it covers all medications, not just SSRIs, but it's put out by SafeRx, which is a New Zealand resource. And again, quite handy for your elderly patients as well. It just goes through almost every available drug and tells you what can be crushed or dissolved and what can't.
That'd be really, really useful in this context. I mean, particularly, is it one of Zeno's paradoxes? You know, you sort of remove it, you know, take half a dose, half a dose, half a dose, half a dose as your reduction. You know, you'll never actually end up. It'll go
That's
on
right.
forever.
Infinite. Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting that this. So there was in the marketing, the early marketing, I think for some of the SSRIs, doesn't need any withdrawal. You know, you can stop this because it's got such a long half-life. You can just stop it and you won't get any side effects. And I think this really debunks that and gives a really good guide as to how to manage it. But as you say, if we can actually get some ability to dissolve or crush the medication, I've certainly had patients before who've said that they're shaving just a little bit off a tablet. And taking that, and you sort of wonder how psychological it is.
Yeah, but
But
I must admit, I had plenty of patients that used to do that, and I would think that it was psychological because it's almost homeopathic. But in fact, it may well be just that they're at that slowest end of the tapering process.
But and the other thing I think when you're starting the medication, being really clear about this is going to be really important. And hand, you know, giving people that medication advice sheet that we keep talking about at the start of the medication, so that you're aware. I mean, obviously, people are in distress when they're starting the medication, but just, you know, making them aware that this is going to be a slow taper to get to stop it rather than just stopping it themselves. I know we probably are all doing that anyway, but just it re-emphasizes that.
Absolutely. And the patient information leaflets on New Zealand formulary, again, easy to access and print off at the start of treatment, and they cover a lot of the stuff as well. Number
Thanks, Dave.
two.
That gives me a bit of a plan for what I should be doing over the next 7 or 8 months.
Well, as long as you've had your 9 months minimum or whatever it is. So the second one just is an historical reminder. Really, just I had a colleague recently who ran into a bit of strife with an elderly patient who'd been prescribed miconazole gel and whose INR became quite significantly supratherapeutic. Luckily, the patient didn't start bleeding. But there was a reminder that came out in prescriber update a few years ago around the interaction between miconazole gel and warfarin. So miconazole gel inhibits the metabolism of warfarin. And has been shown to have significant effects in some patients on the INR, so enough to actually kill them in some cases that have been notified, unfortunately. So it's just that the warning that you need to monitor the INR closely if you are co-prescribing warfarin and miconazole oral gel, or avoid it in preference of nystatin if you're concerned.
It obviously, I assume it will come up as an alert when you're prescribing it for somebody with warfarin, but we've almost become habituated to almost to ignoring a lot of those alerts that pop up in front of us, haven't we?
Yeah.
So it's a reminder to actually slow down, have a look and see if there's anything that really is significant there, because you wouldn't necessarily associate an oral gel with a significant side effect like that.
Absolutely. And I think again, as that fatigue alert, I mean the number of times I've seen steroid interactions come up when the patient's got a steroid cream, which I just ignore. So it would be easy to overlook it in that context. The other interesting thing, just when I was doing a bit of research around this, is the other contraindication or condition on miconazole oral gel prescribing, which is around its use in children less than 6 months of age. So the manufacturer data sheets actually state it's contraindicated in children less than 6 months of age, while the New Zealand formulary notes it's not approved for use in children under 6 months of age. So you're using it off-label in that group. But NZF does prescribe dosing instructions for neonates and infants under 6 months of age. And that dosing is for infants and young children, give oral gel in small amounts at the front of the mouth or smear around the inside of the mouth. Do not place gel in the back of the mouth as this may cause choking. So it is all around that choking risk of putting a quarter teaspoon of gel in the back of the throat of a young child with an impaired swallowing reflex or immature swallowing reflex.
It's not uncommon for there to be a little variations between the data sheets and the advice in the formulary, and they'll often, and I think the formulary is pretty consistent with saying this is off-label use. But you know, I think
that you come across that, you know, not infrequently.
And the danger is, of course, Dr. Google, when the patient, you know, somehow comes across the professional information sheet and throws their hands up in horror. The other interesting thing, because again, I would sometimes tell women to put the oral gel, smear it on the nipple,
yeah,
when feeding a young baby, to treat the baby that way. And again, there's total variation. So some NHS guidance says never use myconazole oral gel on the nipple ever, yeah. And yet it's advised in some other resources. So I think again, it's don't put a huge dollop on your nipple, because it's the same as putting too much into the back of the baby's mouth. But I can't see that a smear on the nipple is going to cause any swallowing issues. No.
And the issue is around choking and just the viscosity of the gel.
That's right. Yeah. Purely a mechanical issue. So. Okay. So now we've got patients surviving those interactions.
Right.
We're trying to get small patients to survive lung cancer.
Yeah.
So this is a perennial issue, but there's been a recent Goodfellow gem which refers to a Goodfellow unit webinar, which I've put links in the paper version of the snippets. Yeah. But it's around early detection and advances in management of lung cancer. So there is probably one of the main issues in New Zealand is the inequitable outcomes for Māori and non-Māori in terms of life expectancy related to lung cancer. So it's a leading cause of death for Māori women and second leading cause of death after cardiovascular disease for Māori men. And Māori women's rates are more than four times higher than non-Māori, and men's rates nearly three times higher than those of non-Māori.
Yeah.
So there's a study, I think it started or is due to start, using low-dose CT screening for lung cancer in high-risk Māori patients of a certain age group.
The fact that this is, as you say there, the single biggest contributor to the difference in life expectancy to Māori and non-Māori is a message that we really need to get across. This is incredibly important for us to have some plans around identifying early and getting in there. Because if you identify it early enough, it's treatable.
Yeah. But sadly, I think it's some large proportion, something like 70%, that are stage four at the time of diagnosis.
Mm.
And another figure that is a little sobering, and I'll talk about it in conjunction with the symptoms, is just the sensitivity of plain chest x-ray for diagnosing lung cancer. So there was a 2021 systematic review that showed, and this looked at primary care patients with symptoms being having chest x-rays performed in primary care. So these are symptomatic patients, and sensitivity was around 80%. So, you know, 20% of lung cancers will be missed in symptomatic patients on if you take that chest x-ray. So the GEM looked at the eight symptoms to consider for rapid diagnosis of lung cancer. And these are the same symptoms that are presented in the Health Pathways and the Ministry of Health H-scan definitions. But essentially, it's cough for greater than 3 weeks. And I'll talk a bit about that in a moment. Hemoptysis, chest or shoulder pain. And I think these are preceded by unexplained.
Right.
Dyspnea, hoarseness, weight loss greater than 10%, unresolving chest infection, or symptoms suggestive of metastasis, liver, bone, brain, or skin.
Yeah.
And so in some parts of the country, if the chest x-ray is suggestive of a curable lesion, referral for chest CT can be bypassed, but referral to the respiratory team as the next step is the way to go. E-referral should state high suspicion of cancer, when a PTCT may be the next step rather than a straight high-resolution CT. So where I have problems is, you know, something like cough greater than 3 weeks and someone with COPD who's a smoker, you know, everybody, they all cough more than 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's throwing in your clinical suspicion. But certainly if there's been a change in the cough pattern or it's associated with any of these other symptoms, the message I'd give is don't be reassured by a normal chest x-ray. That if the symptoms are persisting, refer. And I've seen numerous cases where the normal chest x-ray has been falsely reassuring. And then in the spite of obviously deteriorating symptoms and weight loss, etc., nothing, it's just been assumed that it can't be cancer.
Yeah. And how many of those cases where the cancer does eventually reveal itself, when they go back over the chest X-ray, they say, "Oh, yeah, you can see it there," you know, the, you know, and that it's, but it's a shadow within the shadows in the chest X-ray. It's, I totally understand how that's overlooked, or, you know, it doesn't. The retrospectroscope's a wonderful tool.
That's exactly right, but very hard to explain to the affected patient, unfortunately. Yeah. So out of those symptoms, I guess the cough and the weight loss would be the ones that I see leading my colleagues astray. Weight loss particularly, so it's often not spontaneously reported by the patient as far as I can see. Mm. But what I'll see is that the weight has been taken sequentially over, you know, 18 months or so, and there's been really significant weight loss, but no one's ever actually gone back to look at the sequential weights, and it just hasn't been taken into consideration in the clinical picture. So I think if you're going to take the weight, somebody's weight, or you're monitoring somebody's weight, just take that extra step of ensuring that there isn't some sort of unexplained weight loss going on. Don't rely on the patient to spontaneously bring it up as a symptom or concern.
Mm.
And obviously, I think if you're dealing with a multi-patient, you probably just need to have an even lower threshold for going ahead with further investigation or referral if there are persistent symptoms.
Because that step towards referral is often a really difficult one in this sort of situation, because you the service at the hospital end may not pick this up as they say, you know, somebody's got a bit of vague chest and musculoskeletal pain, Māori guy who stopped smoking 15 years ago, and, you know, he's lost weight, but he's also diabetic and has just started on metformin. You know, there's lots of other explanations for why this could be happening. So that in those sort of circumstances, it's then about making sure that we're aware and we're following people up and we're keeping this within our diagnostic decision tree as an awareness, so that as these things evolve, you can step in as early as you possibly can. And the false reassurance of the negative chest X-ray is, it's almost harmful to do it, isn't it?
I would totally agree with you there. I think if you've got suspicions and you get the referral rejected, you know, I would discuss with the patient and make a, you know, set a definite time for review, even set a definite time to repeat a chest X-ray. But as you say, just make sure there are active attempts to keep them on your radar, so you don't end up in a year's time diagnosing advanced lung cancer. On to something totally different, the other end of the spectrum, which is crying babies.
I'm looking forward to this as a new grandfather.
Put away your prescription pad.
Okay.
So this came out from a recent Tools for Practice, which looked at the clinical question, in infants less than 1 year of age, when crying or irritability is attributed to feeds, do proton pump inhibitors improve symptoms over placebo without additional harms? Mm. So the context of this is that frequent effortless regurgitation of feeds is very common in early infancy. So more than 40% of infants will have spilling or a degree of reflux, not associated with vomiting per se. Regurgitation accompanied by distress symptoms such as crying, back arching, or irritability have traditionally been attributed to reflux disease.
Mm.
But while PPIs improve the esophageal pH in infant randomized controlled trials, they don't improve symptoms. So that they're not actually effective in making the baby happier. In general, guidelines recommend against empiric trials of acid-suppressing drugs for crying or distress or regurgitation. Patients can be reassured that frequent regurgitation can be normal and frequently settles. So around 90% have resolution by the age of one. Well, that's a hell of a long time to have a crying baby. But what we're stuck with often is, I'm not sure if it's as common these days, but, you know, I used to have numerous mothers of or parents of young babies coming in requesting PPIs because everyone else in the coffee group's babies were on PPIs for their reflux. But the conclusion was PPIs do not improve crying, fussiness, irritability, or regurgitation attributed to feeds, but they may increase the risk of serious adverse effects such as respiratory tract infection, from 2.5% on placebo to 12% at 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So definitely more, the NNH is much higher than the NNT. And local health pathways state use of omeprazole in infancy is not indicated in primary care as there is a lack of evidence for its effectiveness and concerns about its safety. Evidence for use and safety of alginates, and that's like your Gaviscon sachets, is inconsistent. They may have a role in treating infants with reflux disease, but only for an on-demand use rather than regular or long-term use.
Which is good. I mean, do they... Because we've got to have some options, as you say, you know, it's likely that the baby's going to grow out of it. Sometimes that reassurance is what parents need. And the behavioral things, you know, sitting up after feeds, smaller, more regular feeds, feed thickening, I believe has some sort of an impact. And then, you know, potentially the intermittent use of Gaviscon infant. As long as people have got options and things that they can do, then... You know, they need some tools in the toolbox.
That's
for
yeah.
3 o'clock in the morning when you've been up for, you know, four weeks in a row, just terrible.
Yeah, and I think that is probably what led to, and the theory seems fine that if a PPI suppresses acid, it should help the problem if the you know, if the problem is acid, but obviously it doesn't in this age group.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You're right. I think it is. It's education, as you say, education and non-drug methods certainly helpful. And I think there are quite a few printed resources out there, printable resources for mothers with these irritable colicky or refluxy type babies.
Yeah, and I have to say, the last clinic I did, I had a mum and baby in exactly this circumstance, and I've picked up this issue around PPI. She asked directly for it. Exactly as you said, because she'd heard through the, you know, through her friends that this was something that was an option that she should try, and they hadn't really tried anything else. So yeah, it was a fairly easy conversation. Yeah, great reminder.
So the next one is I found quite interesting. It's an ongoing discussion around aspirin and primary prevention of CVD. And this may, I guess, may eventually result in our guidelines changing. But a recent issue of the GP Research Review, and there's a link to that. By the way, it's a really good resource to subscribe to. It just comes in your inbox periodically. But it commented on a recently published literature review and meta-analysis of the use of aspirin with or without statin across all risk groups in patients without confirmed cardiovascular disease. So not people that have had an MI or angina or imaging that's shown confirmed CVD.
Yeah.
So the investigators concluded that in patients, these patients, the risk of major bleeding associated with aspirin is greater than the reduction in MI risk across all risk levels.
Mm.
So even if you calculated risk as 18%, the risks of aspirin outweighed the benefits.
Yeah.
So the concurrent use of a statin reduces the cardiovascular benefits of aspirin without influencing bleeding risk. Therefore, in patients without confirmed CVD who are already taking a statin, the addition of aspirin is unlikely to achieve a meaningful cardiovascular benefit but would increase the risk of major bleeding. Current health pathways recommendations are, though, that you consider aspirin, but only for high-risk patients younger than 70 years, taking, and this is primary prevention we're talking about, I'll emphasize.
Yeah.
Consider only for high-risk patients younger than 70 years, taking into account the benefits and harms. If not high-risk, aspirin and other antiplatelet agents for primary prevention alone are generally not recommended. And if older than 70 years, the balance of benefits and harms of aspirin is not clear, so is not recommended for primary prevention alone.
Yeah.
So it's really only the first of those, I think, that may alter. First of those recommendations may alter as this review perhaps embeds itself into guidelines.
Right. Yes. So it makes it even less valuable to give the aspirin, and probably more valuable to use the statin for the cardiovascular risk reduction.
Yeah, I think that's the statin really is the valuable drug to be prescribing.
Yeah. What does that interaction between aspirin and statin say about people like myself who are on this for secondary prevention? You know, is the statin interfering with the impact of the aspirin?
Well, I think my impression was that it was more that it didn't provide any marked additional benefit. If you weren't taking a statin, then for secondary prevention, if you weren't taking a statin, then I would presume that that aspirin confers some benefit in terms of reducing risk.
Yeah.
But if you're taking a statin, it makes you think, well, why would you, if it has no benefit in this situation, why would it have benefit with known cardiovascular disease? But I presume the studies have shown in that context.
Well, I think it's whether you should take the higher dose, as a 100 kilo guy, should I be taking 300 milligrams rather than 100 milligrams of the aspirin? And if I'm already taking the statin, so if this sort of points me more towards taking the 300 milligrams than the 100 milligrams.
As long as you're not vomiting blood every second night.
Thank you. Thank you. And just send the bill for the consultation.
But I think this would give me reassurance that if I've got somebody with, that I'm using it for primary prevention, risk, say, of 16%, who I'm having to put on omeprazole because of the gut irritation from their daily aspirin, and they're on a statin, I'd feel reassured about stopping the aspirin and the omeprazole and knowing that I'm not apparently putting them in any harm.
Yeah, absolutely.
So second to last, winter virus action plans. As part of its ongoing commitment to antibiotic stewardship, Heiako Haringa, they've developed some virus action plans for adults and children, which are modifiable, so you can personalise them. So essentially, you can personalise them online. So if you go to the site, come to the virus action plan, you can type the patient's name in, you can tick which non-antibiotic self-help measures might be helpful for them, including rongoa, if you've got skill in that area. Follow up when they should seek help, if symptoms deteriorate or new symptoms, and other resources they can read. So it just makes it a bit easier to give them something, I guess, that they feel has been of use to them when you're not prescribing the antibiotic. And there's a similar one for children that you can, again, modify and print off for the patient. But avoiding antibiotic prescribing and good antibiotic stewardship, I think something to keep at the forefront of our minds.
Still,
whatever the season.
And that, I love that, the addition of the rongoa option there for people, just showing their respect and for that option. And as you say, not something that probably many clinicians have a great deal of information about as yet, but there are courses, and there's lots of information that we can start learning around that. But just the fact that it's there in the form will increase that, the fact that the health system is showing respect and thinking about the impact of rongoa, I think is phenomenal, really.
Yeah, and it may be one of those situations where you can actually learn from your patient just by bringing it up if appropriate and learning, saying, is there something that you might use?
Kawakawa tea. I can pretty much guarantee it'll be kawakawa tea, but that's I'll leave that there.
The turmeric of the Maori world. So last topic is, and again, I think there's been a lot of public publicity about this in the popular press as well as medical press, but it's...
That's good. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, that's been a bit around. But so the recent MedSafe prescriber alerts commenting on the risk of neurodevelopmental disorders in children fathered by patients using sodium valproate at the time of conception. So the prescriber alert gave information for healthcare professionals and also a guide which can be provided to, a written guide can be provided to all male patients of reproductive potential using sodium valproate. But essentially they're saying, or noting that the data sheet has been updated to include new safety information related to males. Use of sodium valproate at the time of conception by people who are able to father children has been linked to a potential increased risk of neurodevelopmental disorders in children compared to those who took lamotrigine or levetiracetam, and states inform patients of this potential risk and consider alternative treatment options for those wishing to father a child and discuss the need for effective contraception when starting sodium valproate and periodically throughout treatment. So again, I guess the groups that might slip under the radar are the younger males, not yet of reproductive potential, who become, who will age and become able to reproduce.
Mm.
Not quite sure when that is these days, probably about 12 or 13.
12, 13, but, yeah.
But just being aware that the information is out there and there's a, you know, some responsibility to pass on that information to the relevant drug medication consumers.
I think this is huge. I know that the pharmacists are going to be informing people when people are picking up their medication, which is great, but we shouldn't be relying on that. We need to be thinking about this when we're doing a repeat prescription request. This is somebody who's on sodium valproate needs to have this conversation at the time of the next repeat prescription. But those are the people who won't necessarily get the information. I mean, it's great that it's been out in the public press. I think that's fantastic. But it really is beholden on us to be aware of this and to make that additional effort to warn people that this is new information at a repeat prescription. And obviously, again, giving people the appropriate leaflet if you think about starting the medication. Although, again, this would make me, you know, even less likely to start Epilim as a first option.
And I think in primary care, I guess we may be starting it more often for mood stabilization.
Yeah.
As opposed to epilepsy necessarily. But the guide, the link to the guide is there. And I think whether it's worth running a search of male patients within a certain age group that are being prescribed at the moment and targeting those or not, I'm not sure whether you do it more opportunistically as the patients come in. But there may be some out there who are planning right at the moment to, you know, father a child and who may or may not be aware of this information.
Yeah, I think my understanding from what I've read around this from Pharmac is that there's an encouragement for us to review people when their medication comes up for review. So that rather than having to proactively go out and identify patients as we did with Accuretic when that was found to be contaminated with the carcinogen, there was a definite plan for going out and identifying patients, swapping them in a very proactive manner. Whereas for this, the advice has been periodically inform people. And at the time of a repeat prescription, that's a good, that's your opportunity to have that conversation. Fantastic.
So that's it for June.
Wonderful. So we've talked about sodium valproate. I love the winter virus handout from Heiko Hiranga. The aspirin and primary prevention and basically further reinforcement that it's probably not worthwhile at all. Not using PPIs in crying babies, both because it doesn't work and also because it increases the risks of infection. Lung cancer, signs of early signs of lung cancer, the things we should look out for, and particularly for our Māori patients, something to refresh and to keep front of mind and then to follow people up if we have suspicions, even if there's a normal chest x-ray. Reminded about miconazole, and even though it's an oral gel, it can interfere with warfarin and increase the INR. And then for me to slowly stop my antidepressant tablet. I'm not an antidepressant tablet, so I shouldn't joke about it. But the significant range of side effects, which we all know about with as we withdraw antidepressants, they're far more likely than we thought. You know, 30 to 50% of people will get side effects, and B, we can really help to modify by doing this 50%, you know, even reduction by 25% of the daily dose, slowly catchy monkey.
And the just that guide to crushing or altering tablets, this is the guide. I've just flicked it up onto the screen.
Yes.
But it runs through all, you know, a huge range of drugs and gives information around what you can and can't do with them.
So more than just antidepressants?
Oh yeah, no, it's all drugs.
Oh, fantastic.
Or a whole variety of drugs that way.
Yeah. That's incredibly useful, actually, to just adding that to the resources that we provide for rest homes.
Absolutely. Yeah, quite relevant there.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, we'll see you again next month.
We'll see you next month. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.